Recorded Books presents Art and Crime by Stefan Koldehoff and Tobias Timm. Translated by Paul David Young. Narrated by Graham Winton. Light and Shadow, an Introduction. The international art market between New York and Beijing, London and Moscow, Berlin and Monaco, has two sides, one full of light and the other dark. Both are the products of a development over the past two decades in galleries, auction houses, and the internet, in which the prices for painting and sculpture have exploded. $250 million for Paul Cézanne's Card Players from a private collection in Geneva. $300 million for Paul Gauguin's Tahitian painting Nafea Fa Ipoipo. $157 million in a New York auction for Reclining Nude by Amadeo Modigliani. $141 million for Alberto Giacometti's sculpture L'Homme au Doigt. And, of course, the already legendary $450 million that a Muslim head of state paid in November 2017 at Christie's in Rockefeller Center on Fifth Avenue for the picture of Christ's Salvator Mundi. Although experts still disagree whether the small wood panel was, as was claimed, to any significant extent painted by Leonardo da Vinci. In total, according to the Art Basel and UBS Global Art Market Report, more than $50 billion flows through the international art market annually. And these are only the prices that are publicized on the daylight side of the market. Here there are respectable auction houses that make special advisory offers to their customers on a level competitive with that of investment banks. Naturally, with discretion and, if it simply has to be, through offshore firms in tax havens, as demonstrated by the plunder of the Malaysian government reserves known as the One Malaysia Development Berhad scandal, or 1MDB. At auctions, these thieves use the hundreds of millions of dollars in stolen Malaysian government money to buy art by Vincent van Gogh and Pablo Picasso, among others. The sales rooms of the galleries that conduct business internationally look like luxury boutiques for exclusive fashion houses, and they aspire to sell the same magic. These multi-million dollar transactions aren't about art. Rather, lifestyle and prestige are for sale. Those who can show off, say, a fresh Jeff Koons hanging on the wall at their next party in the meatpacking district in New York are more than just rich. They belong not only to the minority global class of the well-to-do, whose wealth has grown enormously in the past few years, but also to what counts as the global cultural elite, into which one can buy entry through art. Those who can afford it employ an art advisor who, in exchange for sumptuous payment, takes over the search for suitable artworks and, as a practical matter, can identify simultaneously which artists in the current season are particularly sought after and what prices their works command. That this approach can also go wrong, because agreements aren't kept and big-name artists such as Picasso, Kirchner, and Lichtenstein also paint some bad pictures, became spectacularly clear in the case of the art advisor Helga Achenbach. The entry of investment bankers, stock speculators, and brokers vulgarized the art market completely, he said in an interview. In the stock market, everything is monitored. If you buy stock with insider information, you can expect the authorities to knock on your door right away and arrest you. The art market is easier to manipulate. Achenbach knows what he's talking about. Before he was sentenced to 6 years imprisonment in 2015 because of millions of dollars in art swindling, he had worked as an art advisor for banks and attempted to establish an art-based investment fund. The dark side of the market. There is the other side, the dark side of the lucrative commerce in art. A business that can make as much money as the art market does automatically attracts those who want to play without following the rules. In a villa in the Rhineland, an entire collection of supposedly authentic Russian avant-garde art is offered for sale, complete with a printed catalog on which the logo of an internet photo book publisher is prominently displayed. But that didn't stop a West German entrepreneur from making expensive purchases, nor did the fact that the accompanying expert reports raised questions as to the work's authenticity. Then there's the expert in charge of the catalog of one of the most sought-after and high-priced artists of classic European modernism, who was paid a commission of 91,000 euros by a German auction house for his expertise, a sum which an independent audit found could not be justified. And there's the expert who for years produced scientific verifications of works of art, supposedly worth millions of dollars, that were sent to him rolled up like posters and mailed through regular commercial courier services. Any museum or reputable art dealer would have the pictures framed, packed in highly protective, climatized containers, and transported by special art handlers. These are some consequences of the rapid development of the art market in the 21st century, about which much has been said and written. The story of this development includes the hedge fund billionaires in Manhattan and on Long Island, who make collecting art both a hobby and a profitable investment. And this story is inseparable from ever-growing prices and the way art has become the new status symbol of the super rich, with buyers and sellers in Hong Kong, India, Russia, and South America. It's a story of increasing demand and dwindling supply, because the market is limited in product. Until now, there's been no systematic investigation into how the social and economic developments of the past few decades have turned works of art into investments, and what effect this has had on these cultural goods and our relation to them. In this book, we cover the many reasons for what happened and the consequences of it, providing concrete examples. The art market has always been both one of the most globalized and one of the least transparent markets in the world. If a work by Leonardo da Vinci, Vincent van Gogh, Alberto Giacometti, or Jackson Pollock changes hands, usually just a few who are directly involved in the transaction know about it. How the price is determined, by whom and to whom it is paid, which middlemen or letterbox entities and tax havens are involved, these things are, as a rule, not disclosed. As always, the art market claims for itself special privileges, which were justified over 100 years ago by the uniqueness of the objects for sale. Whereas cash transfers of a relatively low value and real estate transactions must be reported, the purchase of works of art under certain conditions may still be used to move profits from illegal practices, such as extortion or drug dealing, into legal circulation. And art dealing is the market economy in its purest form. Especially at the high end of the market, these are unique goods whose value cannot be established objectively. The price of a painting by Rembrandt, Roy Lichtenstein, or Gerhard Richter is not determined by its weight, the materials used, or even the size. Demand and supply converge on a certain price. An artist, a dealer, or a collector must be ready to part with the work, and another collector, or even better, two collectors, must want to own the work. When only a few people possess a whole lot of money and are ready to spend it on art, for reasons of passion, expertise, prestige, or investment, an ever higher spiral of prices is to be expected. And it doesn't look as if anything about this will change anytime soon. Not a universal indictment. The subjects of this book include money laundering, tax fraud and deception, the consequences of globalization, the connection between art and the mob, counterfeiting at small and large galleries, the secret hoarding of pictures in protected, tax-free, toll-free storage facilities, the dubious market in authentic and counterfeit Nazi relics, and the business of stolen and counterfeit books, which has become more lucrative in the era of digitalization. And yet, our intent isn't to cast suspicion on an entire industry. The overwhelming majority of art dealers conduct themselves properly, adhere to the guidelines and rules, and are genuinely interested in art. However, nothing could be clearer than the fact that those on the right side of the art marketplace must be more forcefully dedicated than they have been until now to calling out the thugs in the industry and exposing, curtailing, and preventing their activities. There is a weird collective spirit in the art world, as expressed in some industry publications, an insistence upon outmoded traditions that invite suspicion, from the handshake deal to the anonymity of business partners, to the code of silence. All of this harms the entire market, and in the digital space, where the worldwide decimation of data happens instantaneously, it doesn't have a future. Instead of stubbornly insisting on maintaining what is in truth already long gone, instead of refusing to work collaboratively and constructively, and instead of paying experts time and again to manufacture counterarguments, it would be so much more meaningful for leaders within the art world to proactively shape the future of the art market together. The connection between art and crime described in the following chapters through some particularly sensational examples is hardly limited to art dealing alone. Museums throughout the world must come to grips with security issues. They remain poorly prepared, both in terms of technology and in terms of personnel, as the 100-kilogram gold coin stolen in Berlin and the break-in at the Green Vault in Dresden demonstrate. So-called inside jobs, thefts by underpaid workers brought in from outside firms, have taken place recently in, among other places, Rotterdam, Paris, Amsterdam, Istanbul, Cairo, and possibly also London. In the summer of 2006, it was reported that 221 objects were missing from the Russian department of the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. In particular, icons and enamel works from the 15th to the 18th century, with an estimated worth of almost $5 million. It was suspected that they had been spirited away to the Far East and South America. According to research by the Moscow daily online newspaper Gazeta, more than 50 million objects have been stolen from Russian museums since the economic reopening of the country in 1990, among them 3.4 million paintings and 37,000 icons. The newspaper estimated the total value of works formerly held in Russian museums now being sold on the gray market at more than $1 billion. In many libraries, archives, and graphic collections of museums, the holdings are not inventoried, let alone digitalized. If, as happened in Naples, valuable books are stolen, or illustrations and early maps are cut out of folios, the theft is often not even noticed. Until both private and public institutions begin to address the security of their holdings according to new higher standards, the situation isn't going to change. The globalization of counterfeiting. Two spectacular cases demonstrate just how international the web of people counterfeiting art is, and how quick and global the pathways that counterfeits can take are. Between 1994 and 2011, the New York gallery Nodler sold work supposedly by world-renowned and high-priced artists such as Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, Willem de Kooning, Barnett Newman, Clifford Still, and Franz Klein that turned out to be fake. Some of the participants in the scheme were a Spanish art dealer, collectors from Italy and Belgium, and a painter from China living in New York who faced arrest when he attempted to flee to his homeland. Finally, there are the various old master paintings that came on the market in the past few years in France, Britain, and the U.S. that turned out to be forgeries. Because century-old pictures feature ancient wood or linen as the painting ground, period-appropriate pigments and binding materials, not to mention the techniques of old masters and the traces of age, they can be much harder to copy than works of classic modernism. Perhaps that's why, in 2011, Portrait of a Man, by the much-sought-after Netherlandish painter Frans Hals, was sold to a collector for $11.2 million by a British dealer in a private transaction through Sotheby's without much critical inquiry. Experts from the Louvre in Paris and the Royal Art Collections and the Moritz House in The Hague had earlier declared the portrait to be solely the work of this master. After testing the material proved that was not the case, the purchaser, a U.S. real estate entrepreneur and art collector from Seattle, returned the painting. The dealer had acquired it together with a London firm and paid $3.2 million for it, to the Italian-based French dealer Giuliano Ruffini. Since then, several other works sold by Ruffini, all of dubious provenance, have come under suspicion as possible fakes. A painting attributed to Parmigianino, Holy Hieronymus, dated 1527, hung in the Metropolitan Museum in New York for a long time, although it contained the pigment phthalocyanine green, which was first sold in 1938. In a 2012 auction, the price of the painting was bid up to $842,000. For 3 years, the National Gallery in London exhibited a discovered painting by Orazio Gentileschi for which a British collector had paid $5 million. The regent Hans Adam, Prince of Liechtenstein, acquired a painting, Venus with a Veil, allegedly from 1531, and by Lukas Cranach, from the Bernheimer Gallery, for 7 million euros. It was seized as counterfeit in March 2015 in Aix-en-Provence in France, as is permitted under French law. In September 2019, a painter from northern Italy, who was associated with Ruffini, was held in custody for a short time, but the court of Bologna refused to send him to France. There was also a warrant issued in France for the dealer's arrest. The Italian Justice Department agreed to transfer him to Paris, but only after he was tried on charges of alleged fraud in Italy. Both claim their innocence. Ruffini told the French counterfeiting expert Vincent Noce, who wrote a book on the case, that although he had sold dozens of paintings over decades, he had nothing to do with their attributions to old masters. He was only a collector, not an expert, he said. All the pictures he sold, he claimed, were certified by experts and curators. The defense attorney for the painter in turn told the court that his client had been pulled into the scandal under false pretenses, through a loan of a painting to a museum. In another case, copies that were sold as originals by the counterfeiter Wolfgang Beltracchi over a period of years could be found in private collections in the U.S. and in exhibitions in France. As we showed in our book Falsche Bilder, echtes Geld, published in 2012, experts from all over Europe had provided the authenticating opinions. And then there's the case of the SNZ galleries in Wiesbaden, Germany, which left clues leading to Israel, Great Britain, and Russia. On the policing side, there are those who collect the clues and spring into action when a crime has been committed. Italy, for example, runs a very effective special department, Carabinieri Tutela Patrimonio Culturale, CTPC, which in 2016 alone recovered works valued at 53 million euros. The General Secretary of Interpol in Lyon collects information about art crimes in all member nations and publishes it in an internet databank that is accessible publicly with a sign-in. In the U.S., in addition to the criminal justice system, the Holocaust Claims Processing Office of the New York State Banking Oversight Division looks for stolen art. And in Great Britain, there's the legendary Art and Antiques Unit, which was enlisted in the 1961 investigation into the theft of Goya's portrait of the Duke of Wellington from the National Gallery, although after numerous reforms, the unit isn't as hard-hitting today as it used to be. That case attracted so much attention at the time that it made its way into the first James Bond film, Dr. No, as an early example of art napping, the attempt to use stolen art for extortion. Insurers once were adamantly opposed to paying ransoms for stolen art, but today the rules are not so clear, and the practice has become popular again. This book also explores this aspect of art and crime. In German prosecutorial offices, special departments for art criminality continue to be the exception rather than the rule. Such departments exist only in the federal government and 3 out of 16 German states. The work of these specially trained prosecutors, who are dedicated to protect and preserve the cultural commonweal, usually ends when an indictment is handed down and a judgment is to be rendered. As shown in the cases of the SNZ galleries in Wiesbaden, or the counterfeiter Wolfgang Beltracchi in Cologne, the prosecutors most often avoid trouble and show relatively little interest in diving more deeply into the cases. While there are hundreds, if not thousands, of instances of stolen or counterfeited works of art, there are only a handful of prosecutions. And even then, in many cases, plea bargains between the prosecutor and the defense result in diminished sentences in exchange for a confession. Criminal structures, international webs, and the whole system of art and crime are reduced in this way to single cases, as if they were the exception rather than something more pervasive. There's obviously no desire to get down to the bone of their underlying social, economic, and most importantly, global structures. Art taken hostage. Mostly it's left to individual experts, attorneys, gallerists, auctioneers, and investigators to attempt to flush out the deceivers and counterfeiters in the face of considerable resistance and great personal risk. The victims of the crimes described in this book are not just billionaires from Monaco and Long Island, but also normal wage-earning apprentices in Upper Bavaria. For some, the fact that they bought a fake is disturbing and nothing more. Others find themselves under existential threat by the deception. Art, however, is the loser every time. It is taken hostage, hidden in modern robbers' caves, and dirtied by counterfeiting. That's why there is so much more to tell on the subject of art and crime. Who procured their collections with money derived from highly questionable sources? Which Greek shipping magnates, whose families own the world's most important collections of Impressionist and Post-Impressionist pieces, worked closely with the fascist military regime in their homeland? Which of the works from these collections by Van Gogh, Picasso, and other modern masters have for some time been on display in the Kunsthaus in Zurich, with their provenance posted discreetly on the accompanying wall plaque as private collection? And how did the Thyssen-Bornemisza collection, which has been exhibited since 1992 in a museum in Madrid, come from a family of industrialists who grew rich by dealing arms to the Nazis? Then there is the attorney and fiduciary Herbert Bartliner, who died in June 2019 in his homeland of Liechtenstein, who administered the fortunes, including the art collections, of countless entrepreneurs charged with tax evasion. Among his clients were the commodities dealer Mark R., who is alleged to have done business with Iran and Iraq, and with the not-exactly-democratic Saudi royal house, with the Togolese dictator Eyadema, and with assorted German Christian Democratic Union politicians, who, through Bartliner's office and the Zaukunink Foundation, among others, organized slush fund accounts connected with the Hessian funding scandal. Also, according to the investigations, Bartliner established four foundations in the name of the wife of a drug boss from Ecuador, who has meanwhile been arrested and convicted by a judge for drug smuggling, money laundering, tax evasion, and murder. An entire wing of the Albertina Museum in Vienna is named for Herbert Bartliner and given over to his collection, which he donated to the museum. It includes seven works of the Russian avant-garde, most of them purchased from one gallery in Switzerland, which, according to the museum, are counterfeit. Sometimes it all comes full circle. This book concentrates on crimes that bring into focus just how far apart theory and reality are in the art world. These crimes reveal the dirty practices that are used to fight for the good, the beautiful, the true. We are concerned with the fact that often only the material value of art, and not its aesthetic or enlightening value, is foremost when art is discussed. On the basis of selected cases and exemplary figures, we unearth structural problems that put on full display what's wrong with the way the art market and the business of art are run. Only by insisting on the necessity of such an analysis can we seriously contribute to freeing our view of art. S.K. and T.T. April 2021.